The first reading after that beautiful anthem is taken from a speech given by Caroline Severance to the Women's Parliament of Los Angeles. She was 80 years old at the time and finally retiring from an active life. She lived another 14 years. Caroline Severance was the founder of the Unitarian Church of Los Angeles. She was an abolitionist, a suffragist, and a founder of kindergartens. She and her husband spent many years in northern Ohio, in Cleveland, and they raised their children there.
Dear friends, I count it a great privilege to be one of you. It is because of you and such as you, both men and women, who face your duties and responsibilities fearlessly, that we are justified in our high hopes. But there is still much to be done to make life worth living for the masses of our fellows. I place justice before charity. And while we must and do recognize the needs of charity under our present conditions, let us look for and labor for the time when industry will be so organized as to make sure that no man, woman, or child in our broad, beautiful land shall be homeless and helpless. When each shall have the certainty of work and of the just reward which ensures all the needed opportunities for the home, for education, and for development. Surely this much is the birthright of every child of God and of every individual of a free people. Never will our land be a civilized country until this is brought about by those who believe that the golden rule is the only just basis for business and for political activities.
The second reading this morning consists of excerpts from a much longer article, which I certainly commend to you. It's on the internet, of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., written for Ebony Magazine, their May 4th, 1966 issue. And this is a little bit longer, so there'll be two voices.
I am convinced that for practical as well as moral reasons, nonviolence offers the only road to freedom. This is not time for romantic illusions about freedom and empty philosophical debate. What is needed is a strategy for change, a tactical program. So far, this has only been offered by the nonviolent movement. Our record of achievement through nonviolent action is already remarkable. The dramatic social changes which have been made across the South are unmatched in the annals of history. Even more remarkable is the fact that this progress occurred with a minimum loss of life.
Not a single person has been killed in a nonviolent demonstration. The bombings of the 16th Street Baptist Church occurred several months after demonstrations stopped. Reverend James Reed, Mrs. Viola Liuzzo, and Jimmie Lee Jackson were all murdered at night following demonstrations, and fewer people have been killed in 10 years of action across the South than were killed in three nights of rioting in Watts.
It is always amusing to me when a man says that he can't demonstrate with us because if someone hit him, he would fight back. Here is a man whose children are being plagued by rats and roaches, whose wife is robbed daily at an overpriced ghetto food stores, who himself is working for about two-thirds the pay of a white person doing a similar job and with similar skills. And in spite of all of this daily suffering, it takes someone spitting on him to make him want to fight. It is as ridiculous to raise the question of self-defense in relation to nonviolence as it is for a soldier on the battlefield to say he is not going to take any risks.
I must continue by this faith. Violence, even in self-defense, creates more problems than it solves. Only a refusal to hate or kill can put an end to the chain of violence in the world and lead us toward a community where men and women can live together without fear. Our goal is to create a beloved community, and this will require a qualitative change in our souls as well as a quantitative change in our lives.
Our most powerful nonviolent weapon is, as would be expected, also our most demanding. That is organization. To produce change, people must be organized to work together in units of power. More and more, the civil rights movement will become engaged in the task of organizing people into permanent groups to protect their own interests and to produce change on their behalf. This is a tedious task which may take years, but the results are more permanent and meaningful.
There is no easy way to create a world where men and women can live together, where each has his or her own job and house, where all children receive as much education as their minds can absorb. But if such a world is created in our lifetime, it will be done in the United States by people of goodwill. It will be accomplished by persons who have the courage to put an end to suffering by willingly suffering themselves rather than inflict suffering upon others. It will be done by rejecting the racism, materialism, and violence that has characterized Western civilization, and especially by working toward a world of cooperation and peace.
In our story this morning, the scent of blooming roses was used by the author as a way of illustrating how extraordinary historical events like one of the nonviolent marches organized by Dr. King, Bayard Rustin, and others scent the very atmosphere of our lives. History is not something tucked away in the pages of a book. History surrounds us, the story says, in the very air that we breathe. I have some examples in my own life. As some of you know, I live downtown on Rich Street, and history scents the very air I breathe in that neck of the woods. For example, the great American artist George Bellows, whose influential canvases are found in museums all around the world, including our own, was born in a house just a block away from where my building now stands on Ridge Street. And just two blocks away beyond that, still on Ridge Street, but toward High, you'll find one of those bronze historical plaques commemorating the first kindergarten in the United States of America, established by German immigrant Luisa Frankenberg among the German-speaking population here all the way back in 1838. She had studied with the inventor of the idea back in Germany, and when she moved here to Columbus to live with family that had already moved here, she started a school where little children could sing and dance and explore the world together and began to learn who they were through the experimentation we now simply call play. Some historians deny that Louisa's school was a real kindergarten, but I beg to differ. When the great Unitarian Elizabeth Peabody founded the first English language kindergarten in America a few decades later, she did not hesitate to honor Louisa Frankenberg as a foremother by seeking her out and spending time with her when Louisa had become an invalid later in life. The education of children of whatever age was a brand new idea back then, and Unitarians, as you might imagine, championed it. Unitarians like Horace Mann championed the first public schools, and women like Elizabeth Peabody and Caroline Severance championed the education of much younger children, believing it's never too early to learn, to grow, to develop, to play, to start. Today, our own congregation features the School for Young Children, a modern, even more refined version of what Frankenberg, Peabody, and Severance began. After a long and remarkable life, Caroline Severance moved to Los Angeles to be closer to her sons and grandchildren. Finding no Unitarian church there, she established one, which still exists and in which I've preached. Over time, she grew a powerful and legendary presence for herself among the women's communities and clubs in Los Angeles. Her years of establishing kindergartens, her work back east for the vote and for the abolition of slavery, garnering her huge respect all around in every quarter. The speech I quoted today was delivered by Mrs. Severance when she was 80 years old. In the middle of the section of the speech I quoted in the reading, she offers us an amazing tour de force visionary portrait of justice, which I must read to you again. I place justice before charity, and while we must and do recognize the need of charity under our present conditions, let us look for and labor for the time when industry will be so organized as to make sure that no man, woman, or child in our broad, bountiful land shall be homeless or helpless, when each shall have the certainty of work and of the just reward which ensures all the needed opportunities for the home, for education, and for development. This great vision of an inclusive nation, energized, as she said later in her speech, by the wisdom of the golden rule, was not a conclusion she developed only later in life. Many decades earlier, in the 1840s, when she and her husband Theodoric left their particular church to found a congregation that eventually became Unitarian, she explained, "We could no longer sit conscientiously under a preacher or in a fellowship where the golden rule of Christianity was not recognized as being applicable to all, whatever the color of their skin or crinkle or non-crinkle of their hair. More than 100 years later, Martin Luther King Jr. shared a vision. He called it a dream, as you remember, with 19th century people like Caroline Severance. And many of you will remember that he said something that coincidentally even echoed a phrase of Miss Severance. "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." Having a dream of justice for all, justice for everyone, like King or like Severance, does not, however, provide a sheet of instructions as to how you might fulfill that dream. Dr. King was inspired, as most of you know, by the practices of Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi was himself inspired by the teachings of the Russian novelist and utopian Tolstoy, by Henry David Thoreau, who himself was raised in the Unitarian Church of Concord, Massachusetts, and the Universalist pacifist Aidan Ballou. And all of these men came to the conclusion that if you beat your dream over someone else's head, if you think your dream needs to be imposed by violence on one and all, then you will never, and I mean never, see your dream realized. Instead, each of these thinkers taught that nonviolence was the only approach that had any chance of success at all. In his May 4th, 1966 essay written for Ebony magazine, King rightly is proud of his achievements and the achievements of the people he organized. "Our record of achievement through nonviolent action is already remarkable," he wrote. "The dramatic social changes which have been made across the South are unmatched in the annals of history." That is correct, by the way. "Even more remarkable is the fact that this progress occurred with a minimum loss of life." He does mention a few deaths, like the Unitarian minister from All Souls Church in D.C., the Reverend James Reeb, or Viola Liuzzo, who was active in the Universalist Church on Cass Avenue in Detroit. But he points out that they didn't die during his nonviolent marches, but in cowardly attacks at night when they were isolated from the huge marching crowds. But what interests me most is his use of the word practical. "Nonviolent means," he says, "are practical." And he adds solemnly, "they are the only road to freedom." King wrote many sermons, and he wrote books based on his philosophy and the studies of his graduate education. But the essay format provided him with a chance to say things I really have never seen him write about in any of his other written materials. In his Ebony essay, he does something that the teacher Jesus used to do, which is to take a criticism and then to burlesque it. In other words, he tosses the critique back into the face of the critic with exaggerated flourish. This is something Jesus did a number of times. Remember what King said? "It is always amusing to me when a man says he can't demonstrate with us because if someone hit him, he would fight back. Here is a man whose children are being plagued by rats and roaches, whose wife is robbed daily at overpriced ghetto food stores, who himself is working for about two-thirds the pay of a white person doing a similar job and with similar skills. And in spite of all this daily suffering, it takes someone spitting at him to make him want to fight. It is as ridiculous to raise the question of self-defense in relationship to nonviolence as it is for a soldier on the battlefield to say he is just not going to take any risks. What does it take, he is asking in his burlesque, to get disenfranchised people to demand their place at the table? What does it take to get people to be allies in this work, to find the place in them willing to fight nonviolently for what is right? Really, he asks, you have to be spit on? Someone has to call you a name? Then you want to make a fist and knock someone's block off? But King reasserts then that knocking people's blocks off accomplishes nothing. In fact, it makes things worse. I must continue by this faith, he writes. Violence, even in self-defense, creates more problems than it solves. Only a refusal to hate or kill can put an end to the chain of violence in this world. That's a hard ideal for many. I understand that. But look, I don't think for one minute that King or anyone comes to a place of nonviolent action or embraces the commitment to not hate because they are superior from birth or are speaking from a holy righteousness that looks down on others as unenlightened fools. I assure you, anyone who has learned not to hate has hated first and pried that hate from around their heart deliberately, finger by finger, and slowly. Anyone who chooses not to use violence, who chooses not to kill, even when violence is used upon them, has experienced his or her own blood running hot first. But then this, I have to believe, is why King insisted that nonviolence is practical. Because it begins with where people actually are. It doesn't rely on authority, either personal or scriptural. It doesn't rely on shame, finger-pointing, or blame, all of which are forms of violence, I believe. It does not begin from a place of achieved perfection. The nonviolent protest is not about forcing others to change the law, cease their own hatred, or reform their own heart because they simply have to. No, it's about presenting a dream, a vision clearly saying, we think this is right. And then patiently and without hatred, working to help others discover that dream for themselves, see that vision for themselves. True, King expressed his belief in nonviolence after some laws had already been changed in the 1950s. And laws will be perceived by some people as a form of force. But King, I believe, would have said something like this, and you're right, this is the cheekiest thing I've ever done in a sermon, imagining what King would have said. The law is what we agree to live by. The law itself stands against violence for the most part and punishes lawbreakers. And so in some ways, it is not really parallel to the kind of force used by the people who want to use lynching as their method of maintaining control. So if some black students in the 1950s, by force of law, can now attend a school once reserved for whites alone in Little Rock, Arkansas, then yes, segregationists will feel that their values have been forced to the mat and will feel resentment. But I think that as long as the law protects everyone instead of just the white crowd, The moral claims proposed by the latter nonviolent marches I led during the 60s would have worked even back in the 50s, were I ready to lead marches back then. And the same change in Little Rock could have been more quickly welcomed by almost everyone without having to be enforced by the National Guard amid cries of, lynch them, lynch them. When I compare King's whole organizational style of justice making with the kind of stuff that goes on a lot today, at least on my computer, I get really frazzled. He said, our most powerful nonviolent weapon is, as would be expected, also our most demanding, that is, organization. To produce change, people must be organized to work together in units of power. More and more, the civil rights movement will become engaged in the task of organizing people into permanent groups to protect their own interests and to produce change in their behalf. This is a tedious task, which may take years, but the results are more permanent and more meaningful. Today, I often get calls to show up for a protest of some sort or another tomorrow or the next day. And it's very clear that there has been very little preparation or organization, except the easy kind available today, an email invitation to show up with the assumption that I know about all the realities involved just because I am self-labeled as someone progressive. To work together in units of power takes a lot more organization than that. I'm happy that our own racial diversity task force is working to be one of those more permanent groups King described, a group working for more permanent and meaningful results, and that King's vision of nonviolence gladdens their hearts. Furthermore, social justice work takes what King calls a qualitative change in our souls. That is, we have to examine our own role in the troubles of the world and not assume that we are finished, righteously just once and for all, and can lecture the rest of the world on how to be more like us. Soul work and justice work, humility and vision overlap almost completely, I say. King believed that nonviolent and undeniably tedious organization leads to more permanent results, and I happen to agree. And I agree with him that nonviolent social justice work is practical. Why? Because it acknowledges that in the world of the spirit, we are all still in kindergarten, learning by experience and experiment more than by authority and book. We are learning by practice, and that's what King's practical means. Like his nonviolent marchers, we learn about making golden rule dreams come true by practice. Social justice work, you see, is spiritual work. It's practice. It's practice. And again, it's practice. And we are practicing to live in history right now, not because something famous, like the founding of the first kindergarten, happened down the street where we live, but because we ourselves right now are making history that will one day be read about by our children's children. What, I wonder, will they be reading?